We have this principal-agent relationships in a supply chain in many levels. You have buyer and supplier. You have within a company, for example, I mean, there's the management and there's the purchasing agent who acts as an agent on behalf of the firm. And then...
The Operations Leadership Podcast with Gautam Basu provides insights for today's business leaders on creating value through operations improvement, process excellence, digital innovation, and organizational leadership.
Hello and welcome to the Operations Leadership Podcast. In this episode, we have a returning guest, Dr. Khatri Kaupi. Khatri is an associate professor in the Information Services Management Department at the Aalto School of Business. And we're going to discuss some of her research in value-based purchasing, public procurement in healthcare services, and also discuss about principal-agent problems. Hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hi, Khatri. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, Gautam. How are you?
Doing excellent. It's been a while since the last time we had the podcast. I believe you were one of the first guests on the Operations Leadership Podcast, so welcome back.
Thank you.
So tell our listeners what you've been up to since the last time we spoke.
It feels like, you know, the same old research and teaching, but obviously new topics in terms of looking at climate change risks and water sustainability, public procurement, healthcare procurement, a lot of interesting stuff. Yeah.
Nice. Very nice. And congratulations. I heard that you were the teacher of the year.
Yes. This year, both the KY Student Union and also the departmental subject club. So, you know,
great.
Good year on teaching front too.
Congratulations. That's really great. And it's really nice to have somebody from the department who represents us so well.
Thank you.
One of the things I know, your past research and the papers that you've written, you write a lot about agency theory and specifically around principal-agent problems. For non-academic listeners of this podcast, could you kindly tell, kind of in a layman's terms, you know, what agency theory is and, you know, what is the nature practically of these principal-agent problems that are quite common?
Okay, yes. So an agency relationship is defined as a situation where a principal engages an agent to do a task on their behalf. So the principal kind of being the boss in the relationship, or if you are talking buyer-supplier relationship, it would be the buyer who is then delegating a task such as outsourcing manufacturing to a supplier. Or, you know, we have these principal-agent relationships in a supply chain in many levels. You have buyer and supplier. You have within a company, for example, I mean, there's the management and there's the purchasing agent who acts as an agent on behalf of the firm and then suddenly becomes the principal again for the supplier. So you have a lot of these kind of delegations of tasks within a firm and then between firms in when we talk of purchasing, obviously, which is my area. So this principal-agent problem or agency problem exists in these, you know, essentially these delegations of tasks. When you delegate a task to another person or to another company, you don't actually get to see everything that they do while doing the task. I mean, if you're a boss, you don't know all the time what all your employees are doing. Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? If you're a buyer and your supplier is somewhere in another country, you don't actually know what's going on behind the, you know, factory walls, and, you know, unless on, you know, you go once a year on an audit and then you get to see a bit of a glimpse. So there's this like information asymmetry. The buyer doesn't see what's happening with the supplier. And then there can be goal incongruence, like is what is in the buyer's best interest also in the supplier's best interest. So let's, if we take an example, say a technology company has outsourced production of a particular component in their product to another firm, a supplier firm. Then when it comes down to assembling that final product and that component into it, it doesn't work in the final product as expected. So what would agency theory say in this situation? It would say, because the buyer company couldn't monitor all the time in terms of what the supplier did for production, they may have used, you know, substandard parts. They might not have put in all the effort and checking in their manufacturing or something like that. We weren't able to monitor them. We didn't see, you know, fully what was happening. It was in their interest to, say, cut costs in their production. And, you know, the theory also assumes everyone is opportunistic in a sense that if there's opportunity to act in your own best interest, you will do so.
Is that like opportunism with guile?
Well, this is where I think the theory, some of the origins may be kind of assume this opportunistic self-interest seeking. I don't necessarily like, particularly when we talk of firms, like, can you assume a firm is fully opportunistic when it comprises of, you know, potentially thousands of individuals? But the original theory kind of does assume that. So this would be a kind of an agency problem, you know, and how an agency theory would then deal with this. What would they say to the buying firm? They would say, you know, penalties. You should build in the contract some penalties that if the part fails, the supplier has to pay for it. You should do more monitoring in terms of it could be like these frequent audits, or it could be, you know, some quality testing, these types of things. So monitoring and incentives. With monitoring, you take care of the information asymmetry issue, so you see more clearly what's happening. With incentives, you take care of the goal incongruence. So you incentivize, for example, based on performance, that we only pay you for the parts that actually function. So therefore, it's in your interest not to cut costs, you know, save on materials and, you know, put the effort in, for example. So again, like this, another example would be this, you know, when you call into some helpline or something, you hear this call can be monitored for quality purposes. So that's a case of monitoring within a boss and an employee type of thing. So they could be listening in. So the employees need to put in the effort in every call, for example. So this is a lot that I work with in terms of like monitoring incentives. In I had this bigger project with funded by Research Council of Finland, where we really looked at this and particularly focused on the information asymmetry. Because while I agree that, you know, with agency theory and these kind of problems can occur, I don't fully buy into the, like, they are always going to be opportunistic other firms that you deal with as a buyer. And I also think, like, while yes, the buyer doesn't fully know what's happening with the supplier, particularly if we talk of, say, complex technological products, new product development, the supplier doesn't necessarily always know exactly what it is that the buyer wants. How is this component going to interact with a lot of other technological, high-tech new components in the product? Like, did the buyer really specify and tell all contingencies and it's going to work under these operating conditions and work together with such parts at whatever technological, you know, I'm not an engineer, as you can see when we get to the tech words, I'll go like, whatever. Then I kind of started this project. We started with this, what if it's the other way around, that there's this hidden expectations. So not this hidden action by the supplier, but hidden expectations by the buyer. So I've been studying a lot of that as well. So how to kind of like make sure that it's not just the buyer who knows what the supplier is up to, but that the supplier would really understand what it is that the buyer really is after. And then, of course, that brings in different types of, it's not monitoring and incentives, it's more like guidance and communication and cooperation that helps there. So we've been looking at those, and particularly then also like, what if there's this part failing or something, like, then there's a question of really like, what was the cause and do you have sufficient information to understand, or not reacting like knee-jerk reactions of it must have been opportunistic. Yeah.
So like when you deal with these principal agent problems, you also have pre-contact and post-contract, right?
Yeah.
So what you're talking about a lot with the information system, there's a hidden local action, right, where you may not know if it's an outsourced manufacturer, what that manufacturer is doing, if it's in a foreign country, whatever. And that's like post-contract.
Yeah.
But then you also have the pre-contract, where you're also kind of have moral hazard type of problems.
Yeah,
right?
and adverse selection, like how do you know which supplier is the best one, or which, you know, employee to hire, and to understand that. That's not something where I've kind of looked at in terms of the information asymmetry, but more I guess it comes down to like then in terms of like supplier selection and what are the proper criteria that you really actually want from the supplier to get the performance that you want. And does the buyer actually even always, would they have actually even know, like, what is it actually? I mean, price isn't necessarily the only thing you should be selecting suppliers on.
Exactly. Maybe just as an offshoot of this, there has been now talk about tariffs. So how do you see tariffs? For example, if we take the case of outsourced manufacturing, U.S., Mexico, now that's hot topic, Canada, or even China, How do you apply this theory for that? Would you see tariffs as an incentive to either reshore or nearshore? What is your take on that? Because what I'm trying to get into is, you know, bridging that theory with the practical application. Because here now we're, you know, coming more towards this protection. Tariffs are in a way protectionist.
Yeah.
So how do you see that, and how do you see, for example, these agency problems applied to this particular context?
Well, that's an interesting kind of scenario, because there the tariffs isn't obviously something that the buyer themselves has chosen to apply as an incentive. So it's kind of like a third party, in this case, the government interfering with the, you know, current or preferred buyer-supplier relationships in terms of providing an extra incentive. So it's very, very good question. I guess it would be actually a very interesting to see how does that impact. But then again, there's this, like, I also see there's a lot of this information asymmetry, like, does the government actually imposing the tariffs know all the selection criteria? Because it, you know, again, like, tariffs tackle mostly the cost aspect, but buyers can and should select suppliers based on skills, you know, trust in the relationship, all these types of things. So whether that then drives the correct kind of buyer-supplier relationship, I don't know. Right. This is where we're getting into the sort of the more macro field, which isn't my study, but I think it's an interesting issue as to, because it only tackles the price aspect in supplier selection.
So if I, you know, look at the principal agent problem, there are two parties, basically, the principal and the agent. So they call that a dyadic. But is there like a more parties that can be actually affected, like, for example, regulatory, tariffs, governmental things? Is there a theory around that would kind of approach that, or is principal agent just buyer seller, two parties?
Well, I think certainly within supply chain context, it's been applied sort of beyond the dyadic. So we often study these triadic contexts, but actually an interesting point, I don't recall immediately a study where the government would be within the triad, but there are often triadic studies within public procurement where you often have like the purchasing department. And then you also have, say, in healthcare, the doctors that could be the third party. Or actually the third party could also be, like, if we're talking medical purchasing, it could be the patient. So either of these could be considered, or any of these three could be considered the principal.
Right.
And then you have the supplier. So the supplier might be serving kind of two principals. There's the medical doctor who wants a certain kind of brand product performance. I'm used to operating with these types of equipment. And then there's the purchasing agent who says, well, we have a budget and we have, you know, public tendering criteria. We need to do it this way and that way. And then you have a supplier who is kind of needing to work with two agents who might have a conflicting, goal incongruence between them as well. And then, of course, there's the citizen who might want, you know, well, just wants the best product to give them healthy lifestyle.
No, it's very, very, very interesting, and I appreciate you kind of bringing to light the practicalities, because it can get quite complex, a lot of these problems. Maybe a question around one of your recent papers I read. It's around value-based purchasing. So could you tell us a little bit about value-based purchasing, what it is, and maybe some contextual applications?
Yeah. So value-based purchasing, basically, I mean, If we look at, well, not to worry, I'm not going to go long into history, but like historically, purchasing has been very price focused. You buy, you know, lowest cost focused. I'm still, to a certain extent, it very much is so, that you have to find the supplier that gives you the lowest price. So if this is the kind of the starting point of how procurement has started and how it, you know, still very much is in many places, if we look at how our buyers, for example, personal incentives for buyers in organizations are often based on, like, are you able to create cost savings compared to a previous year? Then we've already had for, you know, a couple of decades this, you know, we've talked of total landed cost, like, not just look at the price tag, but how much is it going to cost to ship us that product from the supplier, like transportation, right, inventory costs, those types of things. And then even broader, this total cost of ownership. Yeah. Well, what about TCO, like spare parts? Yeah. If it's some equipment, like how many hours do we need to train our whatever employees to use this new equipment or software or something? And is there like maintenance available? All these kind of things that in the lifetime of that purchase, how much is it going to cost you, right, type of thing, total cost of ownership. So that we've had, and I think companies have, you know, taken that on board quite a while ago. And now the next stage is then this, like, because these both still make you look at cost. What are the costs that the supplier causes you or that purchase causes you in many ways? But now it's also this, like, what about the total value of the purchase that you're making? So say, Aalto University would buy a new software that would be very expensive, but would increase our research contributions because it's better at, you know, finding the relevant articles or something, or like some teaching software that makes our you know, lecture prep much more efficient. So then it wouldn't be like just the cost of the software, but Aalto University would get extra value in terms of teaching or research outputs from the software. Or if we look at then like the medical sector purchasing, which is like the article that you are referencing. So, in, you know, a pacemaker, a hip replacement, knee replacement, whatever these kind of medical devices that are being purchased. I mean, obviously there's cost, you should be looking at quality. But then what about also like post-operation infections? How many days does the patient need to be in hospital to recover from that operation? A year after the operation, how good is the mobility of the patient who's had the knee or hip replacement? How often are there post-operation recovery and like this, that do you get some infections? That, right, that was the word I was looking, right, for. Infections from the operation. So it's that, rather than just looking at price, or even like if in a public procurement contract, usually the two options are like tender based on price, or then there's this MEAT, most economically advantageous tender. So that's all the other criteria, which could be something like often it's been quality related, like it might be certain very detailed specifications. The product must not contain these materials, or must contain a certain percentage of these materials, and must not have a failure rate. So whatever, you know, traditional what you would consider quality criteria, but then value-based looks at more the sort of the impact and outcome throughout that purchase life cycle. So it could be indeed, if we go to the healthcare thing, it could be things like these patient benefits. So patient, you know, it could even be things like measuring patient satisfaction in terms of their mobility a year or 5 years after the surgery. It could be the readmission rates to hospitals, the you know, sick days, because that would be also looking at kind of impact not just on, say, the hospital cost and the patient, but also wider, you know, society, like how many sick days can we avoid, how many more productive years in the workforce can this, you know, maybe slightly more expensive medical device for example increase, or things
but
like that.
If I get your point, but even those, you know, because you're talking about patient outcomes, right, as opposed to just cost optimization.
Yeah.
But then hearing you, you know, talk about this, there is also a cost. I can, because when you were talking, I was thinking about what would be the cost, for example, of absenteeism, if the hip replacement or the pacemaker is not good quality. Then the individual will basically be sick from work, take time properly. That's a cost, right? Yeah. If the quality is not good and the person gets infected, let's say the joint or what replacement is not good quality, then the person has to be readmitted.
Yeah.
That's an extra cost.
Yeah.
So in a way, I guess what I'm trying to say is that if it's in some way, it's always tied back to some sort of cost, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, usually we tend to measure value in terms of, I guess here it might be then cost avoidance could be another way to describe it. But for some reason, of course, I mean, these examples were perhaps more value. Well, I guess the patient satisfaction in terms of life and life quality can be. But of course, in other contexts than public procurement, it could be like, you buy more sustainable components. You know, the supplier can guarantee that this is something very sustainable in terms of social environment criteria. Your customers are wanting that. You can sell it with an extra, you know, price. It could be those types of things. But it's true that the examples in healthcare, you could almost talk of cost avoidance in that many senses.
Exactly. Because, I mean, that word value, I mean, it could mean multiple things to multiple people. But I, you know, to me, I'm a very simple person. I think it's economic value, either cost or revenue or some sort of aspect. So it's quite clear to me, you know, if you're talking about patient outcomes, you know, you do it right the first time with a good level of quality. So you don't have to do the rework. So the patient doesn't have to kind of, if we talk about a healthcare context, so that person doesn't miss work, so on and so forth. So, yeah, that makes sense. And, so your work, you've done a lot of work in public procurement. So how does public procurement, how does it differ from the private sector, for example?
Well, I mean, the most often kind of obviously brought out difference is the very strict legal requirements on the process. So public procurement is subject, well, I'm talking now obviously here the Finland case, but I mean, usually it's similar, just a different name and specifics on the law. EU regulations on public procurement. So it means there needs to be fair and open competition among suppliers. There needs to be transparency and all these types of things. So that means, you know, you need to, everyone, all suppliers have equal access to competition. So you need to publicly announce the tender. Then you have to have very, you know, open, predefined criteria based on which you select the suppliers, and the kind of the, how the criteria is applied is transparent. So then you can't kind of, once you get in the offers and then someone suddenly says like, yes, we fulfill all your criteria, and by the way, there's this extra value something, you can't go like, oh, I'll pick them, because that wasn't in your criteria set. So you have to stick to the sort of the predefined. And basically a lot of, you know, the legislation puts a lot of impact on the process. And obviously if you don't follow the process, the losing supplier could, you know, challenge you, put you to market court. That puts a stop on the whole process. So, you know, understandably, it has put a lot of focus on the process in public procurement, and perhaps then not enough on like the supply chain management, the supplier management, all these other aspects. And you know, I'll have to admit it, it's a lot easier to transparently pre-disclose, kind of like announce your criteria if it's price than if it's like we are going to measure whatever something that happens 5 years after the surgery. I mean, let's face it, I don't think most hospitals or public health systems yet have the data to track so that you could actually tie the outcomes to that particular medical device that was inserted into a particular patient 2 years ago and say this was the cost or the cost avoidance afterwards as a result. So it's also, that's a particular kind of challenge as well, that we need just, it isn't just a case of like procurement fixes this way, let's add a new criteria. We need investments into kind of data systems that then enable the procurement to access that data afterwards. I mean, there's some, I found a very kind of a good example from, there's an article that talks of in Denmark where they tried this kind of value-based procurement with the sort of knee replacement implants. And basically they have a contract where the supplier is compensated based on outcomes that the patients achieve. So the patient, you know, a certain time period after the surgery, after the replacement, the implant has been surgically implanted, then the patient's impacts are report certain satisfaction metrics, say a year after surgery, how satisfied they are with mobility and these types of things. They look at the length of stay during the surgery. They look at readmission rates, revision rates, and these kind of like the actual value, say a certain year or 2 years after the actual surgery when the device was used, define whether the supplier receives a 17% bonus or a 17% penalty.
Wow.
On the original price. So, and obviously this kind of thing to see how well it has worked requires several years into the contract. Sure. But at least in this study, kind of the preliminary analysis, kind of like, you know, from the first where they've been able to gather that longitudinal data is showing positive effects.
Did you say 17.
Okay. Yeah, that would be quite a risk also on the supplier, a 70% discount. Well, certainly it would incentivize them, but also could get very costly for the buyer, 70% increase.
But 17 is still quite high. I mean, that is a pretty strong incentive to have the quality there.
I would assume obviously here it has probably been calculated based on the whatever targets you need to achieve that the savings then in the hospitalized times and readmissions will cover the incentive that you pay for the supplier.
And this study in Denmark, how long was it?
I think it was only like preliminary, so they weren't able to have the full data out of all the, because there were different like time points after the surgery. So I think it was only like 1 or 2 years after they had started. So they were calling it preliminary data, so it's not yet concluded. Sure. But there are other, in my understanding, there are some similar examples in Europe, for example, on like different angioplasty and typically these knee or hip replacements or pacemakers. Usually these insertable.
Okay. And I guess you'd probably need some pretty sophisticated information systems to capture the data. I guess readmission you can capture, but other kind of stuff maybe a bit more difficult to kind of capture.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you need to follow up with the patient. You need to kind of be able to link that specific device that has been inserted into the patient and the kind of the resulting whatever hospital visits are they related to that. So, a lot of these, the few articles that are on the topic, they are clearly like single pilot thingies where probably it has taken extra effort to track that data. But again, I mean, in any new thing that you try, of course, you have to try first these pilots and see is it worth it. And probably from a procurement perspective, you need to track the cost of how much did it cost us to get all that data.
Absolutely.
To really see that, because in some cases, the cost of tracking the performance might outweigh the benefits you get.
That's right. And I guess in Finland, is there a centralized kind of system or information system to gather and collate all this data from the patient if it's a healthcare? Is there a system in place?
Well, I mean, now we're slightly out of my kind of expertise area. So, I mean, of course, we have different like centralized systems, but to my understanding, there is nothing that would really connect it to the kind of the procurement and devices. So while, yes, you can probably, like medical professionals can see patient histories, then it's not tied in that way. So at least to my understanding. So we don't yet have, it would require incentives into, or like investments into information systems. It would require incentives also for procurement, because very often in public procurement, it's very budgets. You look at budgets.
Exactly.
And then that drives to price-oriented tendering.
Right. Yeah, I should know the system because I had a couple surgeries in Finland.
Yeah.
And it is actually quite good, the public system, in terms of the history, what you had. But I think you made a good point. How do you tie, for example, a surgery and for example, if it's some sort of supplier that makes a medical device, pacemaker or hip replacement or knee replacement, how do you tie that back to the actual performance?
Exactly.
I think that would be really interesting. Maybe a more controversial question, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And you touched upon it a little bit regarding the budgets.
Yeah.
So working with public procurement, obviously you're working with governmental institutions. So if we look currently in Finland, there is a budget deficit. So how do you see, for example, leveraging these types of formal and professional public procurement practices, creating value? Do you see that being more implemented and leveraged? Because obviously if the budgets are going to decrease, then there has to be higher efficiency and productivity. So how do you see that playing out, in the current circumstance that we're in?
Well, I guess I have a slight worry that it's just going to lead to less testing out these types of value-based procurement. I mean, before the previous parliamentary election, actually public procurement made it to some of these debates. I can't recall, was it maybe the former prime minister who first brought it up, and then all the other parties agreed, like, yes, public procurement is a... That was one of the few savings where most of the parties agreed, like, yes, public procurement is where we can create savings. Mm-hmm. Savings, you know, when we talk of savings in public procurement, then the mindset tends to go to let's save cost. On cost. Yeah. Let's tender based on prices and get lower cost. And you know, certainly there are studies that suggest, for example, that we don't have... for example, I think Janne Jääskeläinen and Janne Tukiainen have made these studies on like how much competition there is in Finnish public procurement. And I can't remember exact numbers, but basically too many public tenders where you get like zero or just one entering the competition. And obviously that isn't good for price-based competition. So certainly there are things we need to kind of like do to make public procurement more attractive in terms of to suppliers. So whether it's like, you know, sometimes it can just be like for small companies too prohibitive to enter because the cost of like getting all the documents for the complicated processes, like you make a single mistake, then you're usually excluded from, you know, further consideration. So there is that stuff that we probably need to encourage the competition in those to get to lower prices. But I wouldn't want to see kind of public procurement as a savings machine. I would more like to see it as this. Is it value or is it cost avoidance, which would mean kind of putting more effort into thinking, well, what are we trying to achieve with these things that we are buying services or we are buying equipment or, well, I guess public sector doesn't really buy materials, but that's, you know, equipment or services or products for, so that it would really go to this, I would hope to see public procurement create savings elsewhere than just the procurement budgets with these kind of value-based procurement approaches.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it makes sense in the sense if you can quantify over the life cycle, and now we're talking specifically around public health care.
Yeah.
If we look at the life cycle of a knee replacement or a hip replacement or a pacemaker, what have you, you know, that makes sense. So. But I guess if you're thinking more short term, which governments tend to do, if there is a budget deficit, they will look at the suppliers and try to squeeze the supplier, right? So it can be counterproductive. Is there a way to find a happy medium?
Probably, if I had the answer to that, I could probably, you know, maybe I should go into politics then, but... I think so. I mean, at least kind of like looking at our research, so this we did these kind of behavioral experiments. So we asked real, not in Finland, but in kind of mostly, I think, UK-based purchasing professionals and managers and then medical professionals. We gave them these hypothetical medical device purchasing scenarios and then, you know, manipulated certain things. So you give basically everyone the same story, but, you know, you, Gautam, get slightly different information than, you know, if there was the next guy sitting to you. And then we see, does that extra piece of information change what kind of a purchasing decision one would make?
Right.
So you manipulate certain variables, and we had over 1,000 individuals in total or professionals taking part in these experiments. We wanted to see like what gets them to buy Telect. In this case, it was a pacemaker, which would have this an envelope around it that is antibacterial or something that prevents infections, which means like readmissions and problems after after the surgery. So if cost-saving incentives on a personal level were present in the vignette that you read in the description, it said that you as a purchasing professional, there's like bonus systems tied to cost savings, basically statistical significant effect on the purchasing professional selecting always the low price device and not the more value adding device.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, this did not have effect on the medical professionals we surveyed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's an interesting thing that kind of shows that, again, like you have these two principles. I mean, obviously, purchasing professionals are used to a very cost-focused looking at our budget, whereas medical professionals are, you know, maybe their principle is actually the patient.
Mm.
And they look at different types of things. And again, there were other factors like we were somewhat surprised and we tried actually different kind of manipulations on like medical information. So purchasing professionals, whether we told them that this, you know, the fact that the device lessens these infections, like trial at a single hospital or like this global randomized trial, which is like the golden star in medical trials, that it's really, you know, kind of tested out globally, that this is actually the better impact that it has. It had no impact. So again, it also shows like maybe like if you're a purchasing professional, you're not used to reading that medical detailed information that would give right. you the proof of the value that maybe you need to believe that this is worth spending more on. So it's also these kind of like, you know, coming back to the agency relationships, public sector of healthcare organizations. Are you telling your buyers lower costs and then you're telling your doctors, you know, improve patient medical outcomes? And then when they come together to buy something from a supplier, or do they actually come together to buy from a supplier? So is there like, you know, conflicting right. incentives within organizations? So at least certainly this kind of, you know, bringing the different parties from the kind of the life cycle of those procurement together and understanding how choices at the in the procurement decision have an impact on cost elsewhere, and then bringing those costs into the purchasing professionals' personal incentives and not just the procurement budget. Because of course, if the procurement professionals get incentivized on whether they save on the purchasing budget, it's not going to help them that the hospital saves, you know, in readmissions $1 million next year if they're told like, sorry, you did badly because your procurement costs stayed the same or increased, you know, by 100,000, whereas we saved $1 million otherwise. But that's not going to, you know, I'm not judging you based on that.
Sure.
So it's also these sort of internal incentive systems that organizations need to think about.
Yeah, it's a very complex problem because, I mean, procurement professionals do usually get rewarded or judged on cost savings, isn't it? Based on the budget.
Yeah, this isn't just a healthcare issue. I mean, this is in general.
Just the function and the profession. So it's a point. So, I mean, you know, going back to the initial thing that we were speaking about, where you have the principal and the agent, there might need to be multiple different parties.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, having goal incongruence and conflicting incentives. It's very complex. How much do public procurement, do they use, let's say, best practices from the private sector?
Well, I mean, I think to the extent that like they are transferable, I mean, certain things related to, say, negotiation tactics are not allowed within the, there are very strict rules on how and at what points you can communicate. And, you know, you have to, in terms of, I mean, of course, there are different procedures in public procurement. Some are called the negotiated procedure, but it's not the same as in private sector negotiation, obviously. So I think there are those kind of, there are best practices, and certainly in terms of like sustainability, I think public procurement has done a lot, and they actually have this like, well, I think it's at the moment available in Finnish and Swedish, not sure if it's in English. I think there are plans to translate already. There's this like Keino procurement criteria bank, where if you're a public sector buyer and you're buying, say, like, I want to buy IT equipment and I want to take sustainability criteria of like water emissions and biodiversity into account, you go to the website, you select I'm buying IT equipment, these criteria, and it gives you a list of this is criteria that you could put into your tendering competition. So there are there are certainly these ways of sharing best practices, but I don't know, in this value-based procurement, I'm not sure if, say, private hospitals are that much further with this than public hospitals. I don't think this is like an established practice, for example, throughout. So I think there's still, and particularly when it comes to like in public sector, we talk of procurement.
Yeah.
No one ever uses the word public sector or supply chain management or something. And again, I understand that with the legislation and needing to re-tender at certain intervals and not being able to, and you know, legally, you can't prefer the earlier supplier. Every time you tender, it needs to be open for everyone. So it does put a certain, you know, challenge on, say, supplier relationship management when every 4 years it could be a different supplier and both parties know this. But I think that's where kind of there is more work in terms of developing public procurement, looking at the supply chain management, looking at risk management, looking at the relationship management that it you know, post the tendering process, what happens. And there, of course, it's developing relations with the supplier, but also this value-based procurement would be specifically developing what does the buyer do once the contract is in place instead of just ordering, but actually tracking the performance of the product throughout its life cycle.
No, I think, it would be worthwhile for the public sector to kind of see, you know, what the private sector is doing and kind of maybe either benchmarking, and I'm not saying having a one-to-one kind of implementation or execution, but understanding what's there. And I totally understand this whole concept of value-based purchasing. It makes total sense to me because at the end of the day, if you look at the life cycle of a product or a service or an asset, especially in healthcare, a lot of these things make sense. So if folks are looking more short-sighted at the medical device that's being procured as opposed to the longer-term product life cycle cost, But then it should be quite open, transparent, and quantified as well.
Yes, that's what then the public procurement legislation, you know, needs. It has to be very clear criteria based on which it's you know, the suppliers are evaluated, and then of course you need to be able to demonstrate that you can get that data throughout the product life cycle, so that you could actually,
Maybe a final question, Khatri. Don't mean to ask you kind of difficult or controversial questions, but I will.
Okay.
So we have a new president-elect in the U.S., and he has been on his cabinet, at least for now until maybe he gets in an argument, has, let's say, entrepreneurs and business people that he's electing to cabinet. And there's probably you've heard this DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency.
Yeah.
So this means, a lot of stuff that's correlating with our discussion where government should be more efficient, productive, also from a cost side. So my question to you is, if that was, let's say, implemented in, let's say, the Nordic countries or even in Finland, how do you think people would react to that?
I don't know, how are people reacting to that in the U.S.? I mean, probably you can get from there. I see a similar risk to the discussions that were in Finland in the elections of like cost savings. That when they say productivity, does it actually mean this long term we have data on productivity, or does it just mean they're looking at cost in terms of personnel budget or something
I think productivity, what they'll measure is the inputs and the outputs. So if you look at the government worker productivity, they'll look at the headcount of the government and say, well, okay, what's the output
for each
group? So that's one measure, but then there is the measure of cost, the budget.
Yeah.
So if we have, you know, X budget for 2025, cut that budget by 20%.
Yeah.
Maybe something will come down the pipe there. And the reason I ask this difficult question is because, you know, there is, let's say, around the world, there has been some economic difficulties. You know, if you look at not only in Finland, but, you know, Germany, the economy is not doing so well. So I think that, you know, these things may or may not come down the pipe, but, you know, having a contingency or options thinking where if there was this type of thinking that kind of came out of, for example, the U.S. and came to Europe and even Finland, I'm not saying that it will, but there may be a probability. What would be the impact of that if it was more short-term kind of cost, budget kind of elements that are really critical? Those would be the main criteria.
Well, I think there's a clear controversy there because I'm going to latch into two terms you said there. They're impact and short term. And I think this is, and now we go a bit more into like economics and obviously I'm like a business scholar, but I think this is the issue that really with these procurement, for example, I mean, the issue with value-based procurement is to look at impact on the long term rather than cost in the short term.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can estimate impact on a short term. So you need to, I would see huge problems with kind of then what's the accountability of such an agency or program if, you know, is anyone going to measure the long-term impact of Dodge, what was it called? Kind of the savings that they create on, is that savings in one place going to create? I mean, certainly there's probably in all governments, there's and in all, not just governments, all organizations, there's probably things that can be done to make more efficient processes. But are those approaches, is anyone going to measure the impact of those efficiency approaches or just the cost savings? So that's I guess, the worry there that...
Sure.
And it isn't just in procurement. I mean, in healthcare, there's a lot of talk now of kind of like the government kind of taking money out of these like preventative things because you need to, you know, take care of the sick people now, but then the more you take money out of preventative things, the more sick people you'll have in the future. So I think the main problem lies with this not really looking at impact on a long term.
But would you say that it's mutually exclusive? Because to me, you know, I'm trying to find a way or thinking about intellectually and also practically that can you do both? Can you move the needle both on long term impact as well as kind of short term budgetary cost savings? You know, perhaps there could be some innovation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know. like technology innovation can help with productivity. I think maybe I don't know. Do we actually have studies where we measure long enough to see the long term impact of short term savings?
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, yeah, it's a very interesting you know. Let's say points. But Khatri, you know, for those listeners that are want to get in contact with you, that are interested in your research, how would they get in touch with you or contact with you if they're interested in your research or your teaching?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I have my web pages on Aalto that lists my publications in Aalto's system. So most of them we try to nowadays publish with open access because we want exactly impact of our research so that it's not just academics who have access to the articles, but actually, you know, public as well or decision makers. So certainly via the Aalto website, both my research and, you know, other information can be found.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Khatri, for your time.
Thank you, Gautam.
That's it for this episode of the Operations Leadership Podcast. I'm your host, Gautam Basu. If you like what you're listening to with this podcast series, then please hit subscribe. And until next time.